From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, an acclaimed gay writer who has chronicled life before and during the AIDS epidemic tells us why he never came out to his own parents and why he's written under a pen name. He's known to his readers as Andrew Holleran. His new novel, The Beauty of Men, helps explain why he kept his homosexuality a secret from his family. Also, a Jungian analyst faces her own death. We talk with Christina Middlebrook, who was diagnosed with terminal breast cancer at the age of 49. She's the author of Seeing the Crab, a memoir of dying. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A House subcommittee has opened hearings into how the White House obtained confidential FBI files on hundreds of people, including prominent Republicans. Congressman William Clinger opened the session by saying the Clinton administration committed an incredible invasion of privacy. The White House says the incident was just a bureaucratic mistake. But Clinger says the committee wants to know if it was stupidity or something more sinister. Meanwhile, the White House has appointed a new internal security chief. He is Charles Easley, who joined the White House staff about 10 years ago during the Reagan administration. President Clinton meets with a group of governors today from states where black churches were burned. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton will host about a dozen southern governors today at the White House. White House officials say the group is bipartisan, and spokesman Mike McCurry says that the president hopes a bipartisan group can send a signal that the U.S. will not tolerate any more church burnings. The president has asked Congress for an extra $12 million to pay for increased federal efforts to investigate the wave of arsons. The money would pay for additional equipment, staff, and other expenses. As many as 36 black churches have burned in the last 18 months. Since the president began speaking out about the church fires, there has been a new wave of burnings. White House officials say they are concerned about copycat crimes, but that it is impossible to know whether the latest incidents were triggered by the additional publicity the president has brought to the fires. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Egypt criticized Benjamin Netanyahu's first speech as prime minister of Israel today. Egyptian authorities found the comments too critical. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
Egypt's foreign minister says even though Mr. Netanyahu talked of peace with the Arabs, his speech was full of no's. Amr Moussa says for Egypt, if the statement indicates anything, it indicates a hardening of Israel's position that would only hurt the Middle East peace process. In his remarks, Netanyahu offered to negotiate with the Arabs without preconditions. However, he repeated his opposition to a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital and returning the Golan Heights to Syria, key Arab demands. Egypt is hosting an Arab summit this week, prompted by the change in Israeli leadership. Cairo had said it would wait to see the actions of the Netanyahu government before passing judgment on his election. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
Presidential candidate Bob Dole is stumping in California today. He's visiting Los Angeles, where he'll deliver a speech on immigration and then attend a Republican rally. He's disputing a new poll that finds he trails President Clinton by 23 percentage points in California. Dole says the race is much closer than that. California is an important state for presidential candidates to win. Dole says he probably only lags about 10 points behind Mr. Clinton in California. On Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 35 points at 5,663. This is NPR. A lawyer for Dr. Jack Kevorkian says a Virginia woman killed herself in the euthanasia supporter's presence overnight. Lawyer Jeffrey Feiger says Lana Jones had a malignant brain tumor and was in terrible pain. Feiger also says Kevorkian wasn't the only doctor who attended Jones' suicide. The North Oakland Medical Center in Pontiac, Michigan, says Jones' husband brought her body to the emergency room last night. An autopsy is planned. This is the 30th reported suicide that Kevorkian has attended. New Jersey Governor Christy Todd Whitman has entered the controversy over same-sex marriages. She says there is no need for a ban on such unions. Gene Dillard reports.
Just one day after 27 state lawmakers introduced legislation to ban gay marriages in New Jersey, Governor Christy Whitman declared that such a measure is probably not necessary. Because of existing case law and questions and requirements of a marriage license, she said it's unlikely a gay marriage could ever be sanctioned in the state. In an interview on Cable Television Network of New Jersey, she said she doesn't favor same-sex unions.
I personally don't condone gay marriages just because I see that as an institution for the procreation of children, and it obviously doesn't happen under the circumstances of a gay marriage.
However, the governor asserted that adults should be able to designate whom they want to receive their benefits, whether health insurance or Social Security. And that applies to homosexuals just as it does to heterosexuals. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
The Army says 9 soldiers are still in critical condition after 2 helicopters collided yesterday in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Authorities say 4 of the soldiers have been transferred to Vanderbilt University Hospital in Nashville. The other 5 are still at the post hospital. 30 people were hurt yesterday in the accident, and 6 soldiers died. The crash occurred during an exercise where soldiers were practicing rescuing other injured soldiers. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Penguin Books, publishers of Penguin Classics. For 50 years, the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Andrew Holleran has been a puzzling figure in the world of gay literature. He first became known for his acclaimed 1978 novel, Dancer from the Dance, about New York's gay nightlife before the AIDS epidemic. He's chronicled life during the AIDS era in his perceptive essays published in the gay paper Christopher Street and in his book of essays, Ground Zero. But here's the puzzling part. Holleran never came out to his own parents. In fact, the name Andrew Holleran is a pseudonym he's used to help keep the secret. His new novel may help explain why. Titled The Beauty of Men, it's about a 50-year-old man who has left Manhattan and returned home to Florida to care for his mother, who has become paralyzed after an accidental fall. He's never told her that he's gay and keeps that part of his life hidden from her even as she dies in a nursing home. Here's a reading from The Beauty of Men, in which the main character, Lark, faces his mother's slow death in a nursing home while he deals with the loss of friends to AIDS.
It's odd that this should have happened almost simultaneously with the onslaught of AIDS, two parallel disasters occurring in the separate compartments of his life. His friends dying in New York, his mother paralyzed down here. There are various theories to explain it. His cousin said, weeping, that his mother's accident had taken him out of New York and saved him from the plague. Sutcliffe told him he was there only to hide from the horror. Another friend, in therapy in San Francisco, told him his mother had fallen in order to keep him by her side out of the world of men. The fact is, 2 things happened for quite different reasons. Eddie and all who followed acquired a virus. His mother tripped on a rug. In the meantime, he has come to realize that whether or not he ever sees the connection between these 2 forms of suffering, these 2 disasters, life will not wait till he achieves his understanding. And that while he may feel time has stopped, it hasn't. In fact, it's only when he walks through the door of the nursing home and sees the faces of the octogenarians in the wheelchairs all turn, like men in a gay bar, to see who's come in, that he feels what he used to when he walked into the Melody Club, young.
That's an excerpt from Andrew Holleran's new novel, The Beauty of Men. Now, you took care of your mother when she was sick, I believe?
Mm-hmm.
And what did she have in the novel?
Well, it's basically, yeah. The novel is a strange mix of the pretty factual and the made up. And I think when I started writing it that I was writing kind of almost a diary as a relief for myself. I was in a situation I had never been in before. I was in a nursing home and I was seeing, you know, images and people and things that most of us don't see unless you have to go into a nursing home. And I was so struck with all of it that I began writing it down. And most of the nursing home stuff, I think, my mother's situation, her quadriplegia, is pretty factual. And a little bit is made up. But I think the core of the novel, the nursing home scenes, are all pretty much as they happened.
And you were living a double life like your character is.
Absolutely, yeah. I was living in New York. It was 1983. AIDS had just begun. My friend Eddie was one of the first people I knew in the whole city, as far as I remember, to be sick. It was my 39th birthday. I had gone down to my parents' town in Florida on a visit, and I remember thinking when I went there that time that I was only going to spend 10 days there, that I couldn't waste any more time in this little town, that, you know, it was just too dull. And halfway through that visit, my parents were away on a trip. I got a phone call saying that my mother had fallen and had broken her neck. And that began the great change. That's when I left New York, basically, and ended up living in Florida, in that town. And meanwhile, Eddie got sicker and died, and he was the first of many, many other people. So I was living those years, which is what this book is really about, those difficult years, the 80s, on two levels, I guess, two separate things. As I just read in that passage, two parallel disasters.
Tell us a little bit about the life you came from in New York.
It was the life that's basically written about in my first novel, Dancer from the Dance. It had kind of ended before 1983. Things were changing a great deal. New generations were coming in, and I was going through, I think, the natural process of middle age then, of withdrawing from things you had done when you were, you know, in your 20s. But the thing that really took over from that was AIDS, and so the life that's described in Dancer from the Dance, which ended for me in about 1981, 82, was ended, you know, doubly by what happened with AIDS.
And it's a life of nightlife and bars and...
It's exactly. It was the same life, I think, that's being led in New York right now. I think all of that's still going on. I think it's been recreated. There's a party circuit that's even more intense than the one that I participated in when I was, you know, in the 70s. The party circuit then used to be simply going around to different clubs in New York and Fire Island, and now it involves going to the Black and Blue Ball in Montreal, going to the White Party in Miami, going to, you know, more things. It seems more intense on one level, but again, it's got this big difference, and that is AIDS.
Now, the life that you moved to when your mother was paralyzed was, in a lot of ways, exactly the opposite of the life that you had in New York. I mean, it was not a life of nightlife and of parties and
no,
so on. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a life of Murder, She Wrote and Jeopardy, Wheel of Fortune. And it was absolutely two different worlds, completely separate, yeah. And I would say that my novel is basically about that kind of difficulty in integrating the two, the fact that gay life in some cases results in a schizophrenia, a kind of splitting for some people.
Well, the kind of splitting that happened in your life happened in part because I believe you never told your mother you were gay.
Right, and that's a scene in the novel, I think the current one, The Beauty of Men. Toward the end of the book, she asks him, and he can't say it. He can't tell her. And it's part of the whole, I think, paralysis of the book that goes beyond hers. That's a kind of paralysis, too.
Did that happen to you? Did your mother, before she died, say to you, well,
absolutely.
Are you gay?
Yes, absolutely. And this book is not, you know, a politically correct poster child for how one should be gay. The thing about fiction, I think, that's wonderful is that you can put down all sorts of things that aren't perfect, that aren't ideal, but to me are the human reality, and I used that as part of it.
So what did you say to your mother when she asked you?
I think it's in the book. I think he reviews all the occasions when he was asked, and in every occasion, he simply finessed it. He simply didn't reply. It was one of those things that happens, I think, often in families where it's known, but it's not spoken, and it's not necessary that it be spoken because it is known. As to why it's not spoken, though, that's fascinating to me, and I don't know the answer.
Well, let's
because
think
obviously
a little bit,
there are people who do speak the words.
Well, let's think a little bit about why you didn't speak the words to your mother. Was it a fear of how it would affect her life?
I think it was a fear of the fact that we were in a very claustrophobic situation. I couldn't predict how it would alter it. And I also think, and I think this is said in the novel, this is ascribed to Mr. Lark, that it's his own feelings about being gay, that it's his problem, not hers. And I think that's a very interesting phenomenon in gay people. You can be forgiven by everybody, if that's the word, but sometimes you can't forgive yourself. In other words, you have your own standards. And if you are ashamed of it, then who cares if the priest, the doctor, the president, your parents, your neighbors all say it's okay. You may have some lingering disagreement with that. This is all speculation. You know, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but that's kind of my take on it.
Are you saying that you still aren't comfortable with being gay?
Exactly. That's the only thing I could conclude. I mean, why didn't I say yes? I'm comfortable with it in many, many, many ways. I've lived, you know, as a gay person, and it's not a problem. And I would never deny it. But at that moment, I did. So I asked myself, why? And that's my only hypothesis. But it may be totally wrong. I don't know.
Right. Had you played out the scenarios of, like, what if I told my mother I was gay? How would it change my life? How would it change her life?
Yeah, and the torture, of course, is the torture of these situations is you do it after the person dies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the worst part.
Well, how did the scenarios play out when you did this imaginary thing?
You know, it's funny because I think I guess my response was the correct one, because when I tried to imagine the scenario in which I had said I was, I couldn't follow it up with anything after that. I couldn't imagine how it would have changed anything. And this is often a phenomenon, I think, I've heard friends talk about, that it is spoken, it is admitted, and then it's never referred to again. I don't know, though. You know, you have to give people a lot of credit. There are a lot of people who are perfectly intelligent, perfectly willing to accept the fact, perfectly willing to integrate it into their own lives. And the trouble with life is you have no idea which ones they are. I came out to my sister, for example, years ago, and we both decided that I shouldn't come out to my father, for example. And my mother, I'm sure, did know. And I'm sure that my case is very, very common, and that there's, you know, there's partial comings out in a lot of families. And frankly, I think that's what makes families wonderful. I think that there's a lot of, if there's love in a family and there's consideration for one another and there's the best interests at heart of the individual members for the others, I think this is really almost an academic issue. I think that people know, and they know as much as they want to know, and that's that.
Now, have you been criticized a lot by gay friends and other gay writers for not having come out to your family? I mean, it's part of the gay ethic in a way to come out of the closet.
I agree with you. And I had to write an article for Wigwag, a magazine that existed a few years ago, on the question of outing people. And when I had finished it, I thought that I had come out against it and said that it was, you know, a violation of privacy and it's a person's individual right to do what he wants with that information. And my editor called me up and he thought I had come out for it. So it's one of those things where I find it a total paradox. If there's nothing wrong with being gay, then there's nothing wrong with being known to be gay. But in real life, once again, to go back to this, I think we're all kind of much more a mess about this. It's not as clear cut. And as far as being criticized by friends, I don't think so. I'm not. If I were really afraid to talk about this, I wouldn't be talking about it now. If I really thought it was a terrible thing, I wouldn't even be discussing it. I'd be hiding it from other people, gay people, but I'm not. I mean, I think it's just a human situation, and I don't think I'm alone in this, and I'm not pretending to be a saint. I admire people who are strictly down the line trying to bring homosexuals out into the public arena, but it's a partial process, and some of us, you know, are lagging behind and doing it halfway or three-quarters of the way.
Andrew Halloran is my guest, and his new novel is called The Beauty of Men. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Andrew Halloran, and his novels include Dancer from the Dance and Nights in Aruba. His new novel is called The Beauty of Men. Andrew Halloran is not your real name. It's a pen name that you've been using throughout your writing career. Why did you take a pen name?
I took a pen name because one day in 1978, shortly before Dancer came out, I was on the phone with my editor, and this ties in with what we're talking about. I said to her, I don't care at all who knows I'm gay, I said, but I would hate to have the wrong people in the little town, you know, my family's living, and use it against them in some way. And she said to me, well, the wrong people are always the first to get a book, she said, so if you feel that way, you should take a pen name. So I had till 5 o'clock that afternoon to come up with a pen name, and I did.
How'd you come up with Andrew Halloran?
I went to school with someone with a very interesting name, and I took his last name and changed the first one. But that's it. No significance to it other than that.
Is the small town that you're from in Florida a town that has a lot of fundamentalist people who would have biblical objections to homosexuality?
Yes. Like everything in Florida right now, it's in this incredible mix of cultures. There's Christian radio stations in my town who broadcast Focus on the Family things. There are a lot of churches. One of the things I love to do in my book was just take the signs, the slogans off the signs that churches put up outside. You stand tall when you kneel to Jesus. In the opening chapter of my book, there is graffiti on the wall of the men's room. In between the sexual stuff, somebody had written, "Jesus loves you." So Florida's this incredible collision of the two cultures, of the rural fundamentalist Baptist often culture and really the Northeast moving down there, and of people who are sophisticated and agnostic and completely urban.
Now, you're a writer, and just about all your writing has had to do with homosexuality in one way or another. I mean, the characters are gay, the themes relate to gay life. And I wonder what your mother thought you did with your time, because you couldn't tell her that you wrote, because then you'd have to show her something, but what you showed her would be gay-related. So, what did she imagine you did with your time?
Well, that was one of the poignant things, I think, that she knew I wrote. I told her about the books as they came out. I told her I'd published a book and stuff. She often asked me to give the books to nurses and aides at the nursing home who knew I was a writer. And to be quite honest, that was incredibly sad for me.
What did you do? Not give it to them, I'd imagine.
Exactly.
And what?
That was extremely sad, but that was also an example of the I guess the unspoken love I wasn't pushed, I wasn't harassed for it. It was requested, I didn't do it, that was accepted, and that was that. But sure, I regret it.
What explanation did you give?
Oh, I think if you say no to someone, and you're often not pressed. I guess I came from a family that was very tolerant in that way and was very considerate in that way. You were not harassed. I wasn't forced to give the books.
There's just so many paradoxes in our conversation, because you were calling your family so tolerant, and yet...
I get what you're saying.
You know, obviously you felt that they wouldn't tolerate your homosexuality,
and,
you know.
Exactly. You're saying
it's just, everything's
actually
really coded.
Yeah, right. I know. And you're saying that it was an incredibly manipulative and controlling kind of
exactly,
of
right. Yeah, that's a possibility, yeah.
Right, that's a possibility, sure. And and I could look at it that way, I suppose, and perhaps one day I'll alter my view. But at the moment, I just didn't feel it at the time that way. I just thought, there's something here that is genuinely irreconcilable. I think one of the reasons I wrote the book, in fact, was I wanted to present that fact, that in life there are problems for which there are simply... As Americans, I think we have this progressive, problem-solving, optimistic, basically, mentality that things can be solved and there is a solution and there is a happy ending. And I felt very guilty about writing a book which doesn't have a happy ending. But
oh, not
that's
only
what
that,
this book is about.
Well, may I add here that, you know, so often the deathbed scene is a time where, you know, people come clean and speak openly about things they hadn't spoken before and reconcile and so on. And that...
Didn't happen.
Right.
I mean,
there was still plenty of love there between the mother and son, but not complete honesty, obviously.
Yeah. But, again, I think the honesty was there. I think that you can have the talk without having the talk.
Right.
That you don't have to have the formal statement.
Let me ask you, when your mother died a couple of years ago, did you undergo a personal transformation yourself because you no longer had to live a double life?
No, it was worse. It's much worse, I think. To me, the book begins where the book ends. I have this feeling that the book ends with Lark sitting in the parking lot in that car. And I think the scales finally have fallen from his eyes about Becker, about the mother, about his life. And to me, that's where the story almost begins. It's like That lady and the dog story in Chekhov with that that last line where you realize he says that, and now all the difficulties started. I think when you go through a change like that, a tremendous life change like that, you view everything differently. And that hasn't played itself out yet, but I know it's happened, and I just don't know where it's going to go.
So did you move back to New York?
Haven't done any of those things. I've watched friends. I've not been the only one in this situation. I found that that other gay people have gone through what I've gone through. Friends of mine whom I met down there, actually, straight and gay, moved down from New York to care for ailing parents. The parents died, and they're stranded down there. They can't go back. Their former life is kind of not in play anymore, and they have to start over. And I've watched them try different things. I've watched them flounder in a way. And while I think of myself as benefiting from having watched other people go through this, it's really no way to avoid it yourself. I think one has to flounder, and one will go through a lot of false starts and come out at the other end eventually, but I don't know when it will be.
So what do you see for yourself in the next few years? What kind of life do you want to have, and where do you want to have it?
It's a total blank. It's a total blank. I'm in an almost odd Jamesian situation where I'm free to do what I want, but the question becomes, is that liberating or is that paralyzing to
mm-hmm.
be free?
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. I have no idea. You know, as you age, though, you get to questions of meaning, I think. One of the things about Lark at the end is that he hasn't had to ask any questions, really, because he's been preoccupied. And I think that as you age, if you're fortunate enough to age, if you're fortunate enough to get to the point where you can ask questions about what did you do with your life, what should you have done with your life, what do you want to do with your life with the time remaining, those questions become things that will lead you to answers, I think. And one of the tragedies I've always thought about AIDS, in a way, was that it upsets me to think of friends of mine who had to end their lives in that way without ever being able to answer any questions or get to the point of saying, this is what I did with my life, this is what I wanted to do with it. I've always thought that AIDS was kind of getting a bum's rush at the end, where you couldn't handle your life's ending the way you wanted to. It was taken out of your hands to a degree, although that too varied from case to case.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrew Holleran, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Holleran's new novel is called The Beauty of Men. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a memoir of dying. We talk with Christina Middlebrook, a Jungian therapist, about facing her own death. She has breast cancer and has had a bone marrow transplant. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a Jungian therapist, Christina Middlebrook has helped others examine their lives and sometimes face death. Now she's facing her own death. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1991 at the age of 49. In 1993, after the cancer spread, she had a bone marrow transplant, a radical and risky form of therapy. She's adapted her journal into the new book, Seeing the Crab, A Memoir of Dying. I asked her why she wanted to chronicle dying.
The reason I needed to do that are two. The most personal one is that I seem to be a person who needs to tell my own story. I've always wanted to do that. And that's just personal to me. Some people, I think, go more private and some go more public when things happen to them. But another more general answer I would have for that is that when normally all of us think of ourselves as a living person, and that is absolutely integral, absolutely crucial aspect of our identity that we just take for granted. We are alive. So when you're in your mid-years and someone says to you, you're a dying person, not a living person, you simply don't know who you are. And it is the most disruptive, at-sea, lost feeling that you can possibly imagine. And for me, beginning to write about that I wasn't a living person who I, of course, anticipated that I'd live to be 80 or 90. And everyone who knew about those things was telling me that wasn't going to be true. And I needed to write then about what was happening to me so that I could make that part of my identity, so that I could get to know who I was again.
You're a Jungian analyst. Do a lot of people assume, well, she's a Jungian analyst, so she's going to have all kinds of answers that are really going to help her deal with dying? You know, there's just like little things that analysts know. They can analyze themselves. They understand their motives and their psychology.
And they've lived such healthy lives because they
exactly,
are a therapist,
right,
and they've worked everything out.
Yeah.
Certainly, I got a lot of that. And, oh, please share with us our insights, your insight. Tell us, you know, it must be easier for you. And, of course, it was not easier for me. Well, I can't measure how it would be for other people, but it was horribly difficult and disruptive and unhappy for me. But I think in the long run, having a larger frame to fall back on of other people's thinking about issues like death has been helpful. But no, I really came to terms with what I didn't know and decided that's the only way to go, is that you don't know and you can't know.
You write that Jungians struggle to accept every event of their lives, that you're zealous believers in integration and vehement enemies of repression. Well, how did that come into play with dealing with your prognosis?
Well, it came into play very much from my wanting to say, well, this has been my life. I am struck with a virulent, terrible cancer at age 49, and it is who I am. It is what my life is going to be. I think another point of view, which might work for some other people, would be to say, I'm going to fight this. It's non-me. It didn't happen. I'm going to get over it. I will not talk about it again. I'll put cancer behind me. I'll say I had cancer, not that I have cancer. And I felt rather lonely when I was first diagnosed to find that that was the prevailing point of view. But what fit for me was to say, I did get cancer. It has happened to me. If I'm going to continue to know who I am and feel that my life is meaningful, I have to take it in unwanted and unbidden as it is and include it in my identity and in the years I have left. So that's where I found myself a little bit lonely, even among cancer people, is that I kept saying I want to take it in. And that was frightening or just different from how other people might handle it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christina Middlebrook, and she is the author of a new memoir called Seeing the Crab, A Memoir of Dying, and she has stage 4 breast cancer. In 1993, you had bone marrow replacement therapy, which is still a very experimental form of therapy in which they virtually kill you and then bring you back to life again. And why don't you give us a kind of short description of what the process is, Christina?
In 20 words or less, huh?
Yeah.
The process medically is to give, in my case, give me so much chemotherapy that virtually all of the living cells in my body are killed. And those would be the fast-growing cells. And that, of course, includes you know that all cancer people lose their hair. For instance, cancer is hair is a very fast-growing cells, and our mucous membranes are very fast-growing cells. And cancer is very fast-growing cells. So the idea is that you give so much chemotherapy that all of these fast-growing cells are killed off. And then when truly you have nothing left in your blood count, show that they're all gone, they replace in you stem cells from your blood that they took out before you had the chemotherapy. Clean, new, healthy progenitors of new cell growth. The idea being that these will be the parents, these will be the new cell generators from now on, and those abnormal cells that were cancer cells are gone. That's the theory.
In practice, after they give you that incredibly high-dose chemotherapy, you are really sick, and you are prone to every opportunistic infection known to man. I think a lot of people who get this radical form of treatment get rashes all over their body, infections all over their body. I mean, it sounds, and plus you're near death. It sounds like hell, and it's a gamble too, because the odds aren't great that this will really keep you alive a whole lot longer. How did you decide, how did you make up your mind that you were going to take the chance and go with this therapy? I think it's a really hard decision to make.
It was a very hard decision to make. The reason I decided to go with it is because it provided me a chance, and the other therapies didn't. And for me to continue with living and living as richly as I could, I needed to hold out the idea that I had a chance, and which is promised. A chance is promised with a bone marrow transplant. Also, after I had my transplant 3+ years ago, and I've had no treatment for cancer since then, I've been living treatment-free. If I had not had the bone marrow transplant, I would have been on chemotherapy weekly, every week, for the rest of my life. I chose to do it all in one great, big, crashing blow. And I've had 3 years treatment-free, and I'm still getting better, and I'm still getting stronger, and I'm really living my life.
I'm wondering, when you were in the hospital during the bone marrow transplant, how your idea about the mind-body relationship changed. I mean, it must be a real Job-like experience where, you know, you're covered with rashes and opportunistic infections. You're a host to every wimpy microbe looking for a home. You have to tolerate pain and grave discomfort and high fevers for several weeks.
Well, what you know from reading my book that I discovered retrospectively, what I had done is I had made quite a mind and body split. And I learned that about myself because a number of months after the bone marrow transplant, when I was home and recovering, I didn't and wouldn't not recognize photographs that were taken in my hospital room. I simply denied that they belonged to me. I denied that I could tell what they were. And so what happened was that in looking at the photographs, I realized that I made the same split off of mind from body as I had done throughout most of the time of that torture you just described when I was in the hospital. And what I pieced together arduously in trying to remember and by talking to my many friends who were with me is that when all those things happened to me, the rashes and the infections and the sores and the pain and the bleeding and the vomiting and all those things you know about, happened and I was alone, I think I just dissociated. I think my mind just, what I called it was my soul, just split off from my body and kind of hovered around. I hovered around in the hospital room, but I just did not stay in the body in order to tolerate that. That sounds a little weird, but I think that's what happens under severe trauma. I think it probably happens to soldiers under fire, and I think it happens to abused children. I think it probably happened to people who were in concentration camps. You make a split because the torture is too much. And what I found, which I think brought me back and why I think I've been able to piece it all back together, is that I was bathed in love from my family. I had many, many visitors who came. I was blessed with the type of visitor I had, because they were able to meet me exactly where I was. They didn't give me pep talks. They didn't say, this isn't happening. They didn't change the subject. They were blessed people who were able to say to me, "How are you?" and then listen to the answer when I told them how bad I was, how much I hurt, how frightened I was, how depressed I was. They would just say, "Of course," or "How awful." And I think when they would come into the room, I would come back, and I would be there, and I would talk with them.
Come back into your body.
I would come back into my body, yes, and I would tell them about my body. I think they were there sometimes when I wasn't, because they told me, I said, crazy, nutsy, off-the-wall things. My husband wrote some of them down because they were so bizarre. So I think there were times when I didn't come back, but there were times when I did. And, of course, this became, I connected with some of the nurses in this way also. So when they came in, I would feel safe enough to come back and talk, and we would discuss sometimes. I have an anecdote to tell about my son that is not in the book. He tells me now that one time he came in and I was very out of it and I wasn't there, and the nurse was trying to talk with me about my morphine, my diluted dosage, and I was very worried, and she was getting very frustrated with me. And he said to the nurse, "We just have to reassure her. We have to reassure her." And I think probably hearing his voice, I came in, came back to my body, and I said to them, "James, they're trying to kill me." And he just said to me, "I know, Mom." They were. I mean, my body thought it was being killed, and it was. But with his presence, then I was able to come back and be reassured and realize the nurse was doing the right thing, which she was doing.
When you were at your sickest and closest to death, do you think you were preparing yourself to let go and die, or were you really struggling to hold on to life?
I think I tried to prepare myself to let go and die. I have to make clear that I never wanted to, but there were times when I felt I had to. And I did give up the fight, and it did break my spirit, and I just thought, well, I can't do this any longer. I'm going to die. I have to give up. This life is too difficult. And so I would try to counsel myself, I suppose, in a way, and I would lie in bed and say, "Let go, Christina, let go, let it happen, go peacefully." But then I would keep waking up, and the next morning would be there.
And what would your reaction be when you'd wake up the next morning?
Well, I used to be confused, because there's a funny thing that happens. With so many infections, I wasn't able to open my eyes. And I'd waken, and I was there in the winter, so I'd waken early in the morning. It was dark. And I'd waken, and I'd be confused, and I was very druggy, so I'd be a little confused about where I was, and then I'd kind of take my fingers and get my eyes open by opening my eyes with my fingers, and I would see that I was still alive, and I would say, "Oh, thank you for one more day." And then I promised myself that I'd never stop saying that for the rest of my life. And now I've recovered well enough, and I take waking up for granted enough that I don't do that.
Do you think that you're forgetting something important by not doing that?
Sure. I think we should all do it. I think I've not so close to my enlightened state now in my remission as I was then. I try to remember. It's harder when you think you're really alive and you're going to live for a while. But sure, I think we should all do that every day.
My guest is Christina Middlebrook. Her new book is called Seeing the Crab, A Memoir of Dying. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christina Middlebrook, a Jungian therapist who has been diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. Her new book is called Seeing the Crab, A Memoir of Dying. Now, did any friends or family or doctors, nurses, suggest that you try positive thinking while you were sick?
Fortunately for me, not in my close circle of doctors or friends, but yes, it's very much out there in the world. And people would say, think positive, and don't talk that way. And I would always feel very lonely. At first I felt very, oh my gosh, I'm doing the wrong thing. Maybe I'm going to make myself die. Maybe I'm going to make my disease worse. And then I realized I didn't have any control over that. If positive thinking worked, then none of us would die. None of us wants to die, so we'd all be alive. So eventually, it just made me feel lonely, and it made me feel also bothered that there was an idea that we were in control of our own deaths, which implies that only bad people die. That those of us who live right, eat right, think right, won't die. Well, we all do.
One of the things that has troubled you, which to a lot of people might seem minor compared to everything else you've had to deal with, is that the drugs you were taking brought on an early menopause. Why has that been so disturbing to you when faced with things that seem far more grave than that?
I think it's hard to imagine life without hormones if you have lived all your life with them. Menopause, the cessation of menstrual periods, is one aspect of that, which was not bothersome to me. But the energy, the sleep, the sexuality, the ease in my joints, in my body, the fluidity and liquid within my skin and whatever, all of those go when all hormones are taken away. And it happened in one fell swoop. It didn't happen to me over a 10-year period. So I think that's what's the trouble with me. People ask me what the worst part for me was. I say it is not the loss of the breast, but the loss of hormones. That includes all of them, estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. To have none of them makes you live a very aged life. I think I've added 20, 25 years to my life in terms of aging from the cessation of these hormones. And that has been very troubling to me because of the quality of my life. My doctor once in a conference said to other doctors, it seems weird to us to address sexuality in the face of death, but that his patients brought it up to him a number of times that to get back into their sexual intimacy with their partners was such a reaffirmation of life that it was astonishingly apparent to him how early that came on after release from the bone marrow transplant. People wanted to get back with their partners and in that kind of connection to life very soon, within months. And it was important, and so he began to hear from both sexes, men and women, where did this go? What's happening? Why doesn't it work for me anymore? So I think something in that is a reaffirmation of life, connection, intimacy with people, intimacy with our loved ones.
Just to explain, too, women with breast cancer are advised against taking estrogen replacement therapy for fear that would increase the rate of cancer or bring it back again, and that's why that's not an option for you.
That's right. I have estrogen-positive tumors, which means my tumors that I had fed on estrogen. I don't know whether or not estrogen causes breast cancer, but I do know that they know that some cancers, once they're here, some tumors, once they're here, feed on estrogen. So you deprive them of their food. You live longer. That's the idea.
My guest is Christina Middlebrook. Her new book is called Seeing the Crab, A Memoir of Dying. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Christina Middlebrook, a Jungian therapist who's been diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. Her new book is called Seeing the Crab, A Memoir of Dying. Christina, I'd like you to read a brief passage from your book,
Sure.
Seeing the Crab, A Memoir of Dying. This is a passage from really the end of the book, in which you're talking about your attitude toward facing death.
Yes, I wrote, my ego fights the idea of my own death. My ego holds as tenaciously to life as anyone else's. I cannot imagine this world without me in it, or at least I couldn't in the beginning. There is nothing I, or any soldier or doctor or commander-in-chief, any director of hematology oncology, or the Nobel Prize winner who discovered the oncogene can do to change how bad I feel about dying in my 50s. My only ally is surrender. I find great relief in surrender. Surrender means I can stop worrying, fretting, and figuring out what I'm supposed to do. I can forget about beating odds, and I can just live my life. I don't need to work harder than I already have, I tell myself, because I've already done everything that I can, and because I didn't do anything wrong in the first place.
Boy, surrender is a word that I think you're not supposed to say when you think you're dying. You're supposed to use words like fighting it and...
Yeah.
What gave you this idea that your ally is surrender?
Well, I did surrender, didn't I, in the bone marrow transplant. I surrendered, and I think I was taught to think that if you surrender, you die. And I did surrender. I thought, oh, this is too much. I'm going to give up. And I handed myself over to what I thought was my karma. And, you know, I didn't die. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's the way to stay alive. I'm just saying it's not in my control. Because I gave up. I stopped fighting. I said, okay, forget it. And I woke up the next morning. And I woke up the morning after that. And I'm still waking up. So the idea that it's not in my control and it's not up to me to figure out what I'm supposed to do, what I'm supposed to eat, what drug I'm supposed to... Well, I won't get into medicine here, but the attitude that I'm supposed to have is going to somehow change that is a wonderful piece of freedom. Okay, it's going to happen. I surrendered. I thought surrendering would mean it would happen right then, and it didn't. That was 3 years ago that I surrendered. I'm in a good remission after a bone marrow transplant, and I stopped fighting.
You think of yourself as dying now, although you've been in remission since the treatment that you got 3 years ago. You say in your book you want an enlightened death. At first you didn't want to hear about an enlightened death. You just wanted to live an enlightened life. Then you start thinking, well, no, it's time to think about an enlightened death. What does that mean to you?
Well, I've come to a point now where I don't imagine that one can live an enlightened life without considering an enlightened death. But I don't know, Terry, that I'll be able to answer this question about what an enlightened life or enlightened death is. I worked hard to think to myself, how do I want to live this life, knowing that I have limited times? And some of my answers were quite silly. I wanted to spend money. I wanted to travel. I wanted to never live as though life would go on forever, which meant also telling my family and my friends daily and regularly that I loved them and to thank them for what they did to me and to meet them, try to pay back to them, give back to them the kind of loving attention they gave to me. And, you know, it ebbs and flows, the awareness of one's own death. I watch it ebbing and flowing in my children. Sometimes they think I'm back forever. Life goes on. Every once in a while something comes up where they remember, oh gosh, yeah, Mom might not be here too much longer. And I don't know which is more enlightened, to be back in my life understanding that I'm going to die or to live feeling the presence of death behind my shoulder, not in a way that I'll put my head under my pillow and refuse to get out of bed, but live with it in that absolutely in the present way, not make future plans because I want to just live in the present. I get confused. I vary between those two. I waver back and forth between them. Sometimes I forget that it's going to happen now. Other times it feels very present.
You know that old silly game, like if a doctor told you you had 6 weeks to live, how would you spend those 6 weeks?
Sure.
Right. So you don't know how much time you have left, but
That's right.
You're thinking it's probably not
as long as you ever thought it was going
to
be.
Oh, I'm going to go in for these tests, waiting to see if the other shoe is going to drop, and they're going to say, well, those lesions on your spine are moving again, or we found something in your liver.
Right.
I go through that every 6 months.
So, I mean, you're supposed to be making every moment count. And what a scary prospect that is. I mean, I could just imagine thinking, is what I'm doing right now making every moment count? Is this worthy of the amount of time I have left? You could just drive yourself crazy.
Yeah, I mean, that's that attempt to become enlightened. I mean, you know, you have to get into it. I still fight, as I said, fight with my children and fight with my husband and have to go to the bathroom and don't sleep well and like some food and don't like some food. And I think that's what really living your life is. I don't think it's going off into a spiritual plane or buying yourself a Mercedes-Benz or whatever, though I certainly did for a long time. I really traveled a lot. I've stopped that. But I think it's just getting right back into the meatiness of this earth and this life we have. And, you know, I love my garden, and it's loaded with aphids, and it's loaded with snails. And I love my husband, and he's a human being. And I love my friends, and we fight sometimes, and my children go through their phases. And if you're really going to live your life, that's what you're doing in the same way you used to do it before. But I think the part that's different is you... for me at least, rather than living on a different plane, I've come to treasure this plane so deeply. I just, it's so wonderful to have a fight with your husband.
Christina Middlebrook, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm just delighted to talk with you after having listened to you all these years, Terry Gross.
Christina Middlebrook's new book is called Seeing the Crab, A Memoir of Dying. Well, I hope you didn't think we'd let this week go by without paying tribute to Ella Fitzgerald. Tomorrow, we'll talk with her biographer, Stuart Nicholson. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
You are the promised kiss of springtime that makes the lonely winter seem long. You are the breathless hush of evening that trembles on the brink of a lovely song. You are the angel glow that lights a star. The dearest things I know are what you are. Someday my happy arms will hold you, and
support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from William Morrow, publisher of Kenneth C. Davis's new book, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, Everything You Need to Know About America's Greatest Conflict But Never Learned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.